This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We're not quite Wheel of Fortune, but go ahead, take a spin, see which policy reform you get to hear about today. Taxes, immigration, healthcare, all of the above? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 9th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The policy overhaul roulette wheel has landed on immigration today with news that the White House has put a price tag on the deal that President made with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi over what to do about DACA and the Dreamers. It is a long-ish list that includes ending federal funding for what have come to be called sanctuary cities, the wall, of course, and cutting the number of refugees the United States takes in. Also, and our slice of the story today, moving from a family reunification immigration policy to one that is skills-based. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what that might mean.
It's true that the majority of legal immigrants into the U.S. come because they're related to someone who's already become a U.S. citizen. The White House says chain migration, where one family member sponsors another who sponsors another, has accounted for about 60% of immigration into the U.S. during the past 35 years. A far smaller percentage comes from workers who get visas because they have some needed skill. Pia Orenius is a senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas.
If you want to do an immigration reform that's more focused on the economics of immigration, then you would certainly shift those shares more towards economic and skills-based and away from family-based.
In fact, that idea is not particularly controversial among economists. Doris Meissner is with the Migration Policy Institute.
I think everybody that is involved in these issues and has looked at it over the years believes, certainly I believe, that there needs to be a better balance.
But how you get that better balance matters. David Beer is with the Cato Institute. He says Australia and Canada got there by increasing visas for skilled workers.
Not by eliminating family-based categories. In fact, both of those countries have higher levels as a percentage of their population of family-based immigration.
Under the White House plan, family visas would be limited to spouses and minor children of U.S. citizens. So no parents, no siblings, no adult children. Beer says that would dramatically limit immigration in a tight labor market where employers need both skilled and unskilled workers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The slot on the policy overhaul roulette wheel next to immigration is health care, which brings us to this. There are reports President Trump is going to pretty much go it alone in getting rid of the Affordable Care Act with an executive order this week cutting out more of the economic underpinnings of Obamacare. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has the story from the health desk at WHYY.
President Trump slashed the advertising budget by 90%. He's threatened to pull billions in payments due to insurers. And now he's got this new executive order.
I call it synthetic repeal.
That's Andy Slavitt, the former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Obama administration.
The president tried to repeal the ACA over the last 9 months. Congress wouldn't do it. So now he's putting together a synthetic repeal to try to get most of what he wanted done without using the congressional process.
Slavitt says another key piece to this strategy, a plan to cut Medicaid as a way to pay for tax reform. Paul Howard with the right-leaning Manhattan Institute isn't sold on this backdoor repeal talk. He sees the president more like some salesman who doesn't want a potential deal to fall through.
We're committed to fulfilling our promises to our base, making some more affordable options available, and also laying some chips on the table and saying to Democrats, why don't you come to the table? Let's try and find a deal here.
If this executive order goes through, plus all the other stuff the Trump administration has done, it could mean young and healthy consumers fleeing the exchanges. A disaster for insurers, says the University of Michigan's Nicholas Bagley.
All this uncertainty is making it very difficult for insurance companies to plan. And that means more and more of them are going to decline to participate or are going to ask for enormous price hikes.
Bagley says while President Trump can cripple Obamacare, he can't kill it. Unless Congress acts, people who get subsidies will keep getting them, and that keeps the market on life support. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
In Puerto Rico news today, some small signs of progress, even though things on the island are still quite bad. Google's parent company, Alphabet, now has a license from the Federal Communications Commission to launch big helium balloons over that island to provide emergency cell service. Last week, it was CEO Elon Musk of Tesla offering to rebuild the island's power grid using solar and battery technology. Good as far as it goes, but there are some risks when the private sector swoops in post-disaster. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
When tech companies show up, it's not pure altruism. Robert Collins teaches public policy at Dillard University in New Orleans.
The reason why companies will come in after disaster is that the slate has been swept clean. There's a void. There's a vacuum.
Which means less red tape and possibly big paydays for solutions. Collins says Puerto Rico's long-term economic problems mean it may be inclined to give corporations free rein.
When that happens, you're going to see health and safety regulations get tossed aside, and there's no guarantee that the locals are going to get most of those jobs.
Local knowledge is too often thrown aside in rebuilding, says Jared Gensel at MIT's Humanitarian Response Lab. He says Puerto Rican leaders need to vet who's offering innovation versus experimentation.
It's not a time to experiment with something that hasn't been proven, but we'd rather leverage ones that have been proven to some extent but may not have been used in this particular way, and that's innovation.
Alphabet used its helium balloons after recent flooding in Peru. Tesla has built solar grids on other islands. Madhu Berrywal with Innovative Emergency Management says companies should not overpromise.
You create a sense of hope, especially when they hear names like Alphabet and Elon Musk, that our troubles are going to be over soon. And then if that doesn't bear out, survivors are affected even more by having their hopes dashed.
Puerto Rico's needs are great, with more than 80% of the island still without power and 3/4 of cell towers down. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Traders took a breather from all that buying today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The exchanges between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have been less than diplomatic. But beneath all the Twitter noise, progress, albeit in small steps, is being made in isolating Pyongyang. Felicia Schwartz had the story for The Wall Street Journal today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of sound and fury, as I said, in public between the two leaders. More quietly, though, and for a year plus now, there's been some things happening behind the scenes. What exactly is diplomacy doing with North Korea?
So diplomats at the State Department have been quietly working to press countries all over the world to, one, downgrade diplomatic presences wherever North Korea has them, and two, to try to cut down on economic ties and guest workers, which is kind of one and the same. So that effort actually started during the Obama administration, but the Trump administration has certainly elevated and kind of put a lot of focus on that effort.
Give me some examples. What kinds of things are happening out there in the world to sort of put the squeeze on North Korea?
So a lot of this is kind of unglamorous, unsexy stuff. For example, one problem that officials have tried to contend with is that North Korean vessels will often like fly a flag of a country that is not North Korea because they cannot, you know, travel very easily under UN sanctions. And so Fiji, for example, you know, very senior U.S. a diplomat recently called on Fiji in a meeting to crack down on, you know, they flagged as many as 10 North Korean vessels that were flying Fiji flags.
All of these businesses and ships and all of this stuff that the North Koreans run, it's all about getting them hard currency, right? Either dollars or euros or whatever it is that they can then use.
Yeah, especially the embassies are a big source of basically cash for North Korea. They're self-sufficient. Diplomats can set up bank accounts in the countries that they are working in because they need those accounts to function. And again, a lot of this is sort of tiny, like flagging accounts here and there. But for North Korea, whose GDP is quite small anyway, like all of this stuff adds up.
Okay. But here's the follow-up. On the theory that countries are not always eager to be seen working with the United States, right? So that's one challenge here. But then the other one is you've got the president and Kim Jong-un yelling and screaming at each other on Twitter. Does that make this kind of diplomacy more difficult?
I don't think it helps, especially in the higher level asks. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty, especially recently, about, you know, does the secretary speak for the president? On the flip side, I'd also say that this campaign predates the Trump administration. A lot of it is sort of lower level, mechanical. Like, there is a bunch of it happening at the working level because many of the asks are quite small. So I guess it's just hard to measure how that will impact this campaign.
Felicia Schwartz, she covers the State Department for the Wall Street Journal, writing today about North Korea. Felicia, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, item number three from the policy overhaul roulette wheel is taxes. The official line from the White House and Republicans in Congress is that they are going to be done with a tax overhaul by the end of the year. The future is, of course, unknowable, but the congressional calendar is pretty much set. There are just 32 legislative days left until the end of the year, and the GOP plan is still little more than a framework. One thing we do know, though, is that the administration wants a more simple tax system with so few deductions and loopholes that most of us would be able to file on a postcard. To get that simple, you got to get rid of a lot of stuff, the alternative minimum tax among them. Republicans say the AMT no longer serves its intended purpose, which was what exactly? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
So a reporter walks into a bar. No, really.
Hey, Bill. Nancy Marshall Genzer.
How you doing, Nancy? How you?
Very nice to meet you.
You will see.
I'm meeting Bill Duggan, the colorful owner of a bar in Washington's Adams Morgan neighborhood called Madam's Organ.
Round shots.
It's late afternoon, well before things get going. If I came back after 8, I'd have to pay a cover to see the band, or a 2-drink minimum to embarrass myself at karaoke. Madam's Organ has entertainment every night, and Duggan says somebody's got to pay for it.
And we got to pay the band, the wait staff. I got my insurance, which is astronomical.
And just hoping that people drink and eat enough to cover the cost won't work. The government operates in a similar way. It also has to pay the band. The AMT is its 2-drink minimum. The tax was designed to ensure that we all pick up our fair share of the tab. Here's how Martin Sullivan explains it. He's chief economist at the nonprofit Tax Analyst.
The intention of the minimum tax is to give the federal government a second bite at the apple if they didn't catch you on your 1040.
The government gets that bite by making filers with lots of deductions calculate their taxes twice, once under the regular 1040 rules and once under the AMT rules. They pay whichever is higher. The typical AMT add-on is around $7,000. The minimum tax got its start in 1969, near the end of the Johnson administration. Here's Sullivan again.
The outgoing Treasury Secretary, he revealed to the U.S. public that there were hundreds of tax-free millionaires. And this bombshell got the public's blood boiling, and that got the attention of Congress, and as a result, the AMT was born.
At first, it was actually an add-on minimum tax. The AMT we have today was enacted in 1979. For you tax geeks, it's Form 6251. Alan Johnston, a retired health policy analyst in Kensington, Maryland, knows that form well.
It's not all that straightforward. It's a very complicated form.
Johnston and his wife, Ann Cross, have paid the alternative minimum tax 4 times.
I have no problem with AMT other than the fact that some rich people still can manage to avoid taxes.
Yes, even the AMT has loopholes. And Sullivan says people with the most money are the most likely to slip through them. The AMT typically ensnares higher income taxpayers, but not the 1%. Except for this guy, who paid an additional $31 million under the AMT in 2005.
The AMT is actually a shadow tax system that requires many people to calculate their taxes two different ways and pay the higher of the two amounts.
President Trump and the Republicans would get rid of the AMT. They say their tax plan would simplify the tax system and remove the deductions and loopholes that made the AMT necessary in the first place. Our bar owner, Bill Duggan, he understands the limits of minimums. He knows they're complicated and hard to enforce, but he says,
there's got to be a payment, and without it, nothing works. And as long as we all pay some share, whatever our fair share is, then it's going to work.
And Duggan says people feel better when they pay up. Or maybe that's the drinks. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, I was always asking my professors, really?
Really? Behavioral economics goes mainstream, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off less than a 10% today, 12 points closed at 22,761. The NASDAQ down a 10%, 10 points finished at 6,579. The S&P 500 gave up 0.1%, about 4 points. 25 and 44. Unilever PLC, the company behind the most recent online video ad for Dove body wash, has apologized after it was slammed on social media and by critics who considered that ad racist. Unilever, which has, by the by, moved more of its advertising work in-house as part of a cost-cutting drive, up a 10% today. Procter & Gamble is in the middle of an expensive and ugly proxy battle. Company's annual shareholder meeting is tomorrow, lost 0.2% today. Bonds were closed today for the federal holiday, and you are listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This isn't news exactly, but all is not well in the European Union. There was the ever-present debt crisis for a while, then the Brexit vote, then Angela Merkel lost ground in German elections. Now there is Spain with the threat of Catalonian independence. Emmanuel Macron, though, has a plan. The new-ish president of France laid out an ambitious reform program not too long ago, much closer cooperation between the member states in defense and immigration, and, most importantly, according to Macron, economics. From the European Desk Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The role reversal has been dramatic. The German leader once dominated the European scene. The French president was a diminished figure. But now, after this year's elections in France and in Germany, Angela Merkel seems to be shuffling off into the wings, and Emmanuel Macron has taken centre stage. The new young French president is brimming with energy and ideas about how to save the European Union and the euro.
Un budget.
Macron has repeated his call for a common Eurozone budget with one finance minister representing all 19 countries that use the euro and able to pump money swiftly into weaker member states. Only with a strong international currency, he said, will Europe flourish in the global economy. Macron may be ascendant, but he cannot hope to push through his reforms without the support of the EU's economic superpower. And, says Marcel Fratscher, head of the DIW Research Institute in Berlin, Macron's proposals were always going to get a generally frosty reception in Germany.
Germans suspect behind every reform proposal on Europe an attempt to get at German money.
Any suspicion that German taxpayers will wind up bankrolling the Eurozone always triggers the same refrain.
The other Europeans, they have lived beyond their means by spending too much and running up debt, and now they want our money.
That's certainly the reaction of one of the key parties heading into Angela Merkel's new coalition. The right-of-centre FDP is strongly opposed to any closer integration in the Eurozone and believes that France, which hasn't had a budget surplus since the 1970s, should put its own house in order before trying to reform Europe. Here's Emily Mansfield of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
French reform, particularly fiscal reform and stronger growth rate, will be a prerequisite before there's any agreement to further risk sharing in the Eurozone.
But Macron will not be rudely rebuffed. Christian Odendahl of the Centre for European Reform in Berlin says the new coalition government will not want to upset the new French president.
Germany does know, and I think the FDP also knows, that Macron and France is incredibly important to Germany and the stability of the European Union, particularly now with Britain out.
It's just that there's even less appetite in Germany than usual for radical reform in the EU, especially after last month's general election. The campaign and the shock result revealed a deep rift between East and West Germany. Easterners supported the far-right AfD party in much greater numbers than did Westerners. Now the country's mainstream politicians are fretting about this rift and about the presence of a far-right party in their parliament. They are preoccupied. EU reform? Forget it, says Marcel Fratscher.
I have doubts that Europe will, over the next few years, really have dramatic changes or dramatic reforms that really is a leap forward in terms of completing the euro and making it sustainable.
Last week, Germany celebrated Unity Day, marking the country's reunification in 1990. But in his speech, the German president spoke mostly about the divisions between East and West. And elsewhere in Europe, 2 million Catalans voted to separate from Spain, while Britain continues with Brexit. Macron and the French may have gotten their act together. The rest of the EU hasn't. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Yesterday, Richard Thaler was a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Nothing at all wrong with that as far as it goes. Today, though, he is the winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Economics for his work showing that people don't always act as rationally as economist models might assume, a field he basically helped create called behavioral economics. We had Professor Thaler on the program a couple of years ago to talk about his book. It was called Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. We're going to pull it out again and play it for you. Here you go. I'm going to start you on the second chapter of this book, the first couple of sentences, and I want to ask you about them. You say, and this is a quote, "I began to have deviant thoughts about economic theory while I was a graduate student." Take me back to those days. What was it like in economics when you started thinking, you know what, maybe we're missing something here?
You know, I was always asking my professors, really? You know, is that really what you think people do? And they said, shut up and, you know, do your problem sets. My thesis topic was the value of a human life.
Yeah.
I asked people a question. I said, suppose you had some risk, 1 in 1,000 risk of dying. How much would you pay to eliminate it? People would give one answer, say $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, how much would you have to be paid to take an extra 1 in 1,000 risk of death? And they'd say, well, I wouldn't do that at all, or I would demand $1 million. Well, economic theory says the answers to those two questions should be basically the same. And they were like way different. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And then I just started collecting stuff like that.
You're not alone in behavioral economics, right? I mean, you know, Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel for it a number of years ago, right? So you're not the only guy. But the question is, why did it take economists, oh, I don't know, 250 years since Adam Smith to figure out that people do wacky stuff?
Well, you know, the thing is, Adam Smith was a behavioral economist. Before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote a book called Theory of Moral Sentiments. And he had stuff like self-control in there. A very controversial topic, one of the things I've studied. Then what happened is in the 1940s, economics started getting highly mathematical. And it was basically because economists weren't smart enough to write down models of real behavior that they started writing down models of highly rational behavior. And then they kind of forgot about humans until annoying people like Danny Kahneman and I came around and started saying, really?
How much does your livelihood and really your career, and this is going to sound like a terrible and boorish question, but how much does it depend on people not being economically sophisticated?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've made a living by pointing out that the emperor doesn't have much clothes on. But I'm not worried about all of a sudden everybody turning into Einstein. And that wouldn't be enough. They'd have to be some combination of Einstein and Gandhi. So, yeah, my career depends on there being humans. When we're replaced by robots, then I won't have anything to do.
Brand new Nobel laureate Richard Thaler on this program 2 years ago. This final note on the way out today, a reminder of the very sticky spot that can be created when corporate social media guidelines, billion-dollar business relationships, and race and politics intersect. ESPN announced today it's suspending SportsCenter host Jemele Hill for violating the company's guidelines a second time. Last month, you might remember, she called President Trump a white supremacist. Last night, after Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones said he would bench players who, quote, disrespect the flag, end of quote, Hill suggested fans who disagree with Jones's position ought to boycott his advertisers. Helps here to know that ESPN's parent company, Disney, is in the middle of a $15 billion broadcast deal with the National Football League. All right, we are pretty much done. Down 0.1% was pretty much the magic number on Wall Street today. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.